Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by SunSounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your SunSounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading from the November 2024 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. So I hope you enjoy the program. We're going to begin with this article titled, Floating on Air. A century on, the country's most beloved Thanksgiving spectacle reaches new heights, by Michael Callahan. The article is preceded by a photograph, which is a colorized photo of the superhero rodent Mighty Mouse as it passes by Times Square in a 1951 parade. That first parade, held on a relatively mild Thanksgiving day in 1924, was extolled as a marathon of mirth in splashy newspaper ads. It was actually more akin to a modest church carnival on wheels, comprising a few marching bands, some clowns, some Mother Goose-themed floats, and a small menagerie of animals on loan from Manhattan's Central Park Zoo that occasionally terrified onlooking children with their howls and growls, the procession managed to trudge a staggering 6 miles from 145th Street all the way down to Herald Square to its final destination, R.H. Macy & Company, America's largest department store. Despite its modest offerings, the parade still drew a crowd. By the time Santa, pulling up the rear, descended from his sleigh and climbed a ladder to sit on an ornate gold throne above the store's brand-new entrance on 34th Street, an estimated 10,000 people were there to cheer him on. It was a crowning achievement in more ways than one. Macy's was celebrating its just-completed expansion to 1 million square feet of retail space, which now gobbled up an entire city block from Broadway to 7th Avenue. With a blare of his shiny trumpet, Kris Kringle sounded the call for the Macy's windows to reveal their holiday displays, which the store had branded the Fair Frolics of Wondertown. Spectators rushed to the windows, reveling in the dancing martinets behind the glass. The parade merited barely a mention in the next day's papers, but based on the crowd size, Macy's thought it had a hit on its hands, soon placing ads declaring that we did not dare dream its success would be so great. It was the birth of a new annual tradition that would become as much a part of Thanksgiving as turkey, pumpkin pie, or football. While Macy's wasn't the nation's first Thanksgiving Day spectacle, that honor goes to Philadelphia's Gimbel's Parade, launched 4 years earlier. Over time, it set the standard for what an American parade could be. Whether you have stood amid the crushing throng, jumping up and down to gawk at a giant Popeye, or simply watch the affair while pleasantly sinking into your sofa, the enrapturing spell of the Macy's Parade, the undeniable pull of its sheer, overwhelming Americanness, never quite fades. Macy's marketing established the parade as a clever, homespun tradition to remind people to start buying Christmas gifts. Two factors came to cement its status as communal annual ritual for the nation. The first was the birth of television, which, starting in 1948, beamed the extravaganza into living rooms nationwide. The other would become the crown jewel of the parade's unabashedly hokey pageantry, its collection of majestic balloons, beginning with a two-story Felix the Cat in 1927. The balloons got ever bigger and more elaborate each year. An inflated army of Snoopies, Underdogs, Bullwinkles, and Yogi Bears lazily bobbing their way between skyscrapers. Each onlooker's face turned skyward in worship. In the early years, the balloons were released into the air afterward, with a return address provided and a reward as high as $100 offered for each one's return. Locating and retrieving the errant, deflated behemoths became a treasure hunt for area thrill chasers. That tradition lasted until 1932, when 22-year-old student aviator Annette Gibson attempted to catch the 60-foot-long balloon of Tomcat with her small aircraft, entangling a wing and sending her plane plunging into a tailspin over Jamaica, Queens. Gibson's flying instructor took over the controls and landed them safely. Over the decades, the parade has evolved into a massive panorama. In 1948, there were 17 floats, 6 balloons, and a few bands. This year's parade will include 27 floats, a dozen marching bands from across the country, more than 60 balloons, 5 to 7 Broadway numbers, various dance and cheer routines, the occasional chart-topping singer, and, of course, those legendary, leggy Radio City Rockettes, a fixture since 1958. Last year, more than 28 million people viewed at home, the largest audience ever. For them, the Macy's Parade is far more than a procession of glittery floats and chorine kick lines. Creating a mere spectacle is one thing, but creating a shared sense of national belonging, a piercing pride in being an American in an era marked by tragic division, is a feat for the ages. When you go to the parade, says historian Doug Matthews, author of the 2022 book Why We Love Parades, Their History and Enduring Appeal, you unconsciously enter a space that's sacred. A miracle on 34th Street, indeed. That completes the first article. The title was Floating on Air by Michael Callahan. Our second article is connected to the article that I just read. Its title is A Most Musical Motorcade. Some of the brassiest acts to grace the event over 6 tuneful decades by Chris Klimek. The Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade was a generation-old tradition when organizers decided to dial up the excitement by adding star performers to the event in the late 1950s. But it wasn't easy to stage a genuine concert on a moving vehicle in cold weather during a live television broadcast. So starting in 1964, the performers would often lip-sync to a playback of music they'd recorded earlier. Here are some of the most memorable musical acts that have gotten America tapping our toes before turkey time. In 1958, Benny Goodman and his sextet, the King of Swing, who'd appeared in the 1934 and 1937 parades as a non-performing celebrity guest, finally got to cook this year on the standard The World is Waiting for the Sunrise. 1973, George Jones and Tammy Wynette. The volatile but prolific country music power couple performed We're Gonna Hold On, the title track from the second album of duets they released that year. They would divorce in 1975. 1980, Sister Sledge. If ever a song was designed to be performed atop a festive, slow-moving barge making its way south down a Manhattan thoroughfare, it's the irrepressibly welcoming R&B/disco anthem We Are Family, released just 22 months earlier, but already a classic. The last is 1996, Bo Diddley. The captain and Tennille, Vanessa Williams, and the cast of Sesame Street were there too, but only the then 67-year-old creator of the Bo Diddley Beat ventured a self-diagnosis, performing his new single, Bo Diddley Is Crazy, atop the Tom Turkey Float. That's the end of that article, A Most Musical Motorcade by Chris Klimek. The next article is The Truth of the Matter. The early polygraph machine was considered the most scientific way to detect deception. But that was a myth, by Susan Salny. In order to catch liars, the ancient Chinese would sometimes give the accused a mouthful of uncooked rice during interrogation, and then ask the person to open wide. Dry rice would indicate a dry mouth, considered evidence of nervous guilt, and sometimes grounds for execution. The notion that lying produces observable physical side effects has stuck with us, and one man thought he'd cracked the science of lie detection in the 1920s, amid a truly modern boom in crime. This was the era of Prohibition, dominated by bootlegging gangsters. Chicago alone was said to be home to 1,300 gangs, and some police departments adopted increasingly brutal tactics to wring the truth out of suspects. Beating and burning detainees with cigarettes, or depriving them of sleep. Unconstitutional, but widely applied across the nation, according to a major report commissioned by then-President Herbert Hoover, these techniques did result in confessions, many of them highly dubious. One police chief in California thought he could usher in a new era in which science would make the interrogation process more accurate and humane. August Vollmer of the Berkeley Police Department was a committed reformer who began recruiting college graduates to help professionalize the force. His interest dovetailed with those of John A. Larson, who had recently received a Ph.D. in physiology from the University of California, Berkeley, and had a passion for justice. Larson joined the Berkeley force in 1920, becoming the first rookie in the country with a doctorate. Vollmer and Larson were particularly intrigued by the possibility of a simple new deception test pioneered by William Marston, a lawyer and psychologist who would later earn fame as the creator of Wonder Woman with her famous Lasso of Truth. Marston unofficially used the test on some criminal defendants during probation proceedings. Larson spent punishing hours creating a far more sophisticated test, tinkering in his university lab on an odd-looking assemblage of pumps and gauges that he would attach to the human body using an arm cuff and chest strap. His device would measure changes in pulse, respiration, and blood pressure all at once during continuous monitoring of a subject under interrogation. Larson believed the contraption would flag false answers via distinct fluctuations etched by a stylus onto a revolving drum of paper. An operator would then analyze and interpret the results. By the spring of 1921, Larson unveiled the machine he called a cardio-pneumo-psychogram, and later simply a polygraph, a nod to the multiple physical signals recorded by the stylus. A San Francisco Examiner report later that it looked like some mix of a radio set, a stethoscope, a dentist drill, a gas stove, and more, all arranged on a long wooden table. However ramshackle it appeared, Larson's innovation, with its continuous battery of measurements, leaped beyond all previous attempts to track the body's involuntary responses. In a frenzy of sensationalist reporting, the press dubbed Larson's polygraph a lie detector, and the examiner swooned. All liars, regardless of cleverness, are doomed. Larson himself didn't quite buy the hype. As he tested the invention, he found an alarming error rate and grew increasingly concerned about its official use. And while many departments across the country embraced the device, judges proved even more skeptical than Larson. As early as 1923, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia ruled polygraph results inadmissible at trial because the tests were not widely accepted by relevant experts. Still, cops kept using the machine. Larson watched in dismay as a former colleague patented an updated version of the idea in 1931. While Larson's original machine collected dust, imitators with sleeker model versions proliferated, all hewing roughly to the same parameters as Larson's, and millions of people were subjected to testing. During the Cold War, the State Department used polygraph tests to oust alleged communist sympathizers and gay employees from the federal government. Many innocent government workers lost their livelihoods, while others who were eventually exposed as treasonous, including the infamous spy Aldrich Ames, managed to dupe the tests. For his part, Larson got a medical degree and spent his remaining career as a psychiatrist. Yet he was forever soured on the polygraph, eventually describing the device as his very own Frankenstein's monster, unable to be controlled or killed. In 1988, Congress finally passed a law generally banning private employers from requiring the test, though some government agencies still turn to it for screening, and police may use it on suspects as an investigative tool under certain circumstances. It's an instrument of great hope, but also great pain, says Kristen Frederick Frost, curator of modern science at the National Museum of American History, where Larson's original polygraph anchors an exhibition, Forensic Science on Trial, open through next summer. In the 1930s, the Berkeley Police Department almost tossed the machine in the trash, but Vollmer thought it might one day have historical value and saved it. In 1976, the Berkeley Police Department donated it to the Smithsonian, where it sat in storage for decades. Over the past 5 years, 7 conservators have helped to revive its motley parts for display. Some of the rubber and plastic had become stiff and degraded. Other parts were fragile, grimy, or missing. The paper was seriously compromised. Today, though, it doesn't look like an old dusty thing that nobody cares about, says Janet Stignito Ellis, the museum's paper conservator. It looks vital. That's the end of the article titled The Truth of the Matter by Susan Salney. This article's title is One for the Books. The savvy college librarian who helped create an iconic New York museum, by Sonia Anderson. Toward the end of the 19th century, J. Pierpont Morgan, the Gilded Age's Wolf of Wall Street, used some of his wealth to amass a vast collection of books and art. He soon realized it needed a home and a skilled caretaker. In 1905, Morgan's bibliophilic nephew recommended one of his co-workers in the library at Princeton, Bell Da Costa Green. Summoned to an audience with the financier, she impressed Morgan and was soon moved into an office in the newly constructed building known as Mr. Morgan's Library in Midtown Manhattan. She would remain at its helm for nearly the rest of her life, and after Morgan's death in 1913, she led the effort to make his vast private collection accessible to all. Now, with the Morgan Library celebrating its centenary as a public institution, Green is honored in a special exhibition. As co-curator, Erica Cialila says, "There's no real way to talk about the history of the Morgan Library without talking about Belle Da Costa Green." Born Belle Marion Greener in 1879 to an elite black family in Washington, D.C., Green was raised by a single mother who eventually moved the children to New York City, shortening their last name. To improve her children's prospects, Green's mother decided they would pass as white. Green's true race would remain a family secret until nearly 50 years after her death. Having honed her librarian skills in summer school at Amherst College and at Princeton, the self-christened Belle Da Costa Green was brilliant as Morgan's personal librarian, cataloging his collection, guiding acquisitions, and helping scholars sift through the library's holdings. When Morgan died, his son Jack inherited most of the collection on the condition that he make it publicly available. In 1924, the Pierpont Morgan Library opened its doors with Green as its inaugural director. She was pioneering in the way she went about librarianship, Cialila adds, noting that Green was building a prominent career at a time when women lacked basic civil rights. She's one of the highest paid women in the country in the 1920s. So to have that kind of clout and be able to say, "What I'm going to do with that is advance access to research," is incredible. That completes the article, One for the Books, by Sonia Anderson. The last article today is What Makes the Dark, Whimsical World of Tim Burton So Compelling? This one by Sonia Anderson as well. An immersive ode to Hollywood's goth king has arrived in London. In a new exhibition at the Design Museum, visitors can view Tim Burton's early artworks, as well as sketches and costumes from Corpse Bride, 2005, Beetlejuice, 1988, and Edward Scissorhands, 1990, and more. It's a strange thing to put 50 years of art in your life on view for everyone to see, especially when that was never the original purpose, says Burton in a statement. Titled The World of Tim Burton, the show toured for years before making its final stop in London. This version of the exhibition, which features more than 600 items, has been expanded and restructured, spotlighting Burton's collaborations with costume, set, and production designers, who proved integral to his films. Many iconic garments by costume designer Colleen Atwood are on display, including the famous Edward Scissorhands outfit, the hand-painted striped dress Christina Ricci wore in Sleepy Hollow, 1999, and the dress Jenna Ortega wore during the dance scene from Netflix's Wednesday, 2022, all evocative of Burton's famously whimsical dark aesthetic. I read somewhere that if you're going to describe his style through references that are in the cultural vernacular, it would be Van Gogh's Starry Night and Frankenstein. Maria McClintock, curator of the London exhibition, tells CNN's Tacita Quinn, "Tim, more than anything, is an artist. He is not drawn to expressing reality. In fact, he probably would say, 'What even is reality?'" The exhibition winds through Burton's career, starting with a section called Suburban Beginnings, which covers the director's early artistic work in his home state of California. The young Burton was inspired by stop-motion animation, science fiction movies, gothic novels, and Dr. Seuss, all apparent in his imaginative drawings. Some of the most thrilling items are the most personal: teen fan art, scribbles on table napkins, university lecture notes, writes Catherine Spooner, a literary scholar at England's Lancaster University for The Conversation. These offer an impression of intimacy, of unadulterated creativity bubbling up from some hidden wellspring of the subconscious. After studying character animation at the California Institute of Arts in the 1970s, Burton apprenticed at Disney in the early 1980s. He made a few short films, including Frankenweenie, 1984, before directing his first feature film, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, 1985. A few years later, he made it big with Beetlejuice. The world of Tim Burton highlights 18 films with information about their inspirations, props, and influence on pop culture. As McClintock says in the statement, Burton begins each film by drawing his ideas. One sketch on view shows the beginnings of the Edward Scissorhands character, with a darkly shadowed face and incomplete knife-like digits. And we have run out of time today. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I've been reading from the November 2024 issue of the Smithsonian. So I hope you enjoyed the program. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed a program and would like to hear it, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, and then click on demand. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.